Hi, this is Jim Daly inviting you to join Focus on the Family for our 40th anniversary cruise to the Bahamas aboard the Disney Dream, November 13 to 17. Sign your family up for the fun at FocusCruise.com. That's FocusCruise.com.
Ships Registry, the Bahamas.
Hi, I'm Lisa, and I've been a Christian for over 35 years. You know, one great resource for my faith has been the daily broadcast app from Focus on the Family. I learn something new every time I listen. It's free from iTunes or Google Play.
What makes humans equal? Simply this: we all have the same human nature. And men and women, you had that human nature from the moment you began to exist.
That's Scott Klusendorf, and you'll hear more from him today on Focus on the Family about the value of all human life. I'm John Fuller, and your host is Focus on the Family President, Jim Daly. And Jim, we have an excellent presentation for our listeners today.
And that message, John, comes from Scott Klusendorf, who is a strong pro-life advocate. He's the president of Life Training Institute as well. And it's exciting, the opportunities that Scott has had to represent the pro-life position in a way that's very compelling, very persuasive. And he's done this in debating on college campuses and elsewhere. He's very gifted at sharing scientific fact and doing it in such a way that draws you into the conversation, kind of common sense stuff. He's very logical. In fact, a few months back at the Pro-Life March, I mentioned Scott Klusendorf to several legislators that they should read his book, because I think it equips people who are pro-life in that arena to really articulate a reasonable and respectful position for the pro-life movement.
And Scott and his wife have four children. You mentioned books, and an excellent one that we're offering today is The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. And be sure to look for that at focusonthefamily.com/radio. Here now is Scott Klusendorf speaking to our staff at Focus on the Family.
A few years ago, I had my youngest son, Michael, with me in London. I was over there speaking on pro-life apologetics, and we had a day off. And we went to the Imperial War Museum. Are there any history buffs with us here today? If you love history, you simply must go to the Imperial War Museum. They have a Spitfire hanging from the ceiling, the plane that helped save the West in 1940. You wonder why this chapel service is not being conducted in German today? One of the reasons is the Spitfire and a little overweight guy named Winston Churchill who likes cigars. But as we were there at the Imperial War Museum, we were waiting to get in, and we were early. And so they had us queued up, and they had us looking at a series of photographs they had placed strategically at the entrance to the museum, and they were pictures of the evacuees. How many of you have seen or read the Narnia series? Why are the children in the country? Well, Hitler was bombing central London. In fact, he wanted to intentionally kill children. Churchill said, "We got to get the small children out of here." And they were put on trains at Paddington, Waterloo, Charing Cross. And you've probably seen the pictures, the black and white photos of those little kids, some of them as young as two, with little numbers they're holding. And they're holding hands, and they're on the platforms there at the rail stations. And many of them are going to leave London and never see their parents again. And I'm explaining this to Michael, and as I am, I feel a tap on my shoulder, and I turn, and here's this short little woman in her late 70s, I'm guessing. She points at one of the photographs and says, "I was one of those children." I grabbed Michael by the lapels. I yanked him over and said, "We will listen to what this woman is about to tell us." I said, "Tell me your story." She said, "In August of 1940, my parents put me on the train at Waterloo, and I never saw them again." "Go on." She said, "11 nights later, London was subjected to a horrific bombing raid, and my parents were killed." I said, "What happened to you?" She got a big smile on her face, and she said, "Oh, I had a good life." And listen to her words. She said, "The family that took me in just stepped up and adopted me." At this point, I'm bawling. And Michael's bawling because I got him by the neck. But notice her words. "They just stepped up and adopted me." And I want to talk with you for a few minutes about stepping up to defend life. I realize, men and women, we live in a culture today where to be pro-life is not greeted with applause. I realize where for many of us, we fear that we can bring anything of value to the abortion debate. And I want you to know that as scary as it might be to defend life, surrender's not an option. And not only that, you can make a difference where God has placed you. And the reality is, this topic of stepping up to defend life is significant for every one of us in this room, because the days of believing a handful of professional pro-life apologists will be able to carry water for everybody else are over. We have all got to step up. Now, what's an apologist? I ought to define that term. An apologist is not someone who runs around and says he's sorry all the time. That's what husbands do. An apologist, listen to you ladies self-righteously laughing. We'll deal with your pride in a few minutes. An apologist is someone who makes a case for what he or she believes. You lay out arguments. You follow the command of 1 Peter 3:15 to always be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within you. To do it gently, but to do it persuasively. Why is that needed? Because we can no longer assume that the next generation has absorbed our worldview or that they're being taught it. Every summer, I come out to Summit Ministries, the finest Christian worldview camp for teenagers anywhere in the world. I come out every 2 weeks and I teach a session on pro-life apologetics. And for the last 3 years, I have been asking the students a question. These students come from some of the finest churches in America. I ask a question at the end of my time with them. I say to them, how many of you before today in your churches ever heard a presentation equipping you to defend the pro-life view? Out of 180 students present at each session, I'm lucky to get 12 who raise their hands. If I refine the question further and say, how many of you have been taught about how we ought to respond as Christians to things like doctor-assisted suicide, reproductive technologies, things like that, genetic enhancements, I'm lucky to get two or three hands that go up. This is something we're all going to have to own, taking up the responsibility, stepping up to defend life. 2 years ago at the University of Georgia, we were filming a television series called Life is Best. And one of the things we did in this series is go out and interview students at the university campus. And I would just have conversations with them. And we met a lot of Christian students, you might be surprised to learn. A lot of them would sit down with me and I'd start talking to them about abortion. We quickly discovered two things. They didn't really know how to defend the Christian worldview on abortion. But even more disturbingly, they had no idea how the issue of abortion linked to the gospel. No one had stepped up and told them how that works. And that's a shame, men and women, because our case is so clear and so persuasive and so simple. Here's the pro-life case. You've wondered, well, what exactly is the pro-life argument? Let me give it to you in a syllogism. Syllogism sounds like a big word. It's just a series of statements followed by a conclusion. Here's the pro-life syllogism. Premise one, it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Conclusion, abortion is wrong. That's our argument. It's very clear and to the point. And I have some good news for you today. You don't need to be a rocket scientist. You don't have to have a PhD. You don't have to have gone to grad school. You don't even need a college degree. You don't even need a high school degree to be persuasive on the pro-life issue. What you need to do is know how to ask three key questions and answer them persuasively. And if you have a handle on these three questions, God will use you wherever He places you to make a difference for time and eternity. You know, my friend Greg Kokel puts it real well. It's not our job to close the sale when we talk to people. We often think, whether it's evangelism or pro-life, that, man, if that person doesn't fall on their knees and say, by golly, I've been wrong all these years, where can I sign up to repent, that somehow we failed. The reality, says Greg, is our job is to put a pebble in their shoe. Have you ever had a pebble in your shoe when you're out hiking? It's going to wear on you and wear on you until you deal with it. And these three questions we're about to look at, will help you be a defender of human life, help you make a case for life, and step up in a world that desperately needs to hear the truth of our position, and they need all of us on board, all hands on deck. So here are the three questions that we need clarity on. Number one, what is the unborn? And I'll explain why that question is critical. Number two, what makes humans valuable? And number three, what is our duty? If you get a handle on those three questions, God's going to use you for time and eternity. Let's look at that first question, what is the unborn? The reason why this question is so critical is many people today simply assume the unborn aren't human. They don't argue for it, they just assume it. By the way, this is an age-old problem when there's a victim class we want to exploit. We don't generally argue against their humanity. We just assume they're not one of us. How do we help people see that the issue is not choice, not privacy? It is what is the unborn. And one of the ways I do that is to help them see that they are assuming things about the unborn they would never assume about a toddler. So, for example, someone may say to me, "Why don't you trust women to make their own personal decisions?" I don't get defensive. I don't start backpedaling. I don't get nasty. The first words out of my mouth, I'll say, pretend I have a 2-year-old in front of me. His parents want to rough him up in the privacy of the bedroom. Should we trust them to do that? The person will, of course, say, no, you can't do that. And my reply is 2 words. I ask, why not? Well, because he's a human being. If the unborn are human, should we rough them up in the name of trusting women? Oh, that's different. The unborn aren't human. The toddler is. That's the question we've got to resolve. We call this tactic trotting out the toddler, and you can use it. You're not arguing the unborn are human. You'll do that later. You're simply showing that's the issue. Are the unborn human like that toddler? And it works for a host of issues like privacy, choice, anything you want to trot out. People simply assume the unborn are not human. We cannot allow them to do this. They would never argue for trusting women if the choice was killing a toddler. Only with the fetus do they argue that way. And our job is to clarify that assumption, bring it out into the open. Well, I've raised the question. I'll answer it. What is the unborn? Now, I'm going to warn you, I'm not going to go to the Bible for the answer. I'm going to go to the science of embryology because the question, what is the unborn, is an empirical question. We'll go to the Bible in a minute, but not just yet. What is the unborn? Here's the answer from the science of embryology. From the earliest stages of development, you were a distinct, living, and whole human being. I want all of you listening to me right now to hold your hands out like this, and I want you to begin pinching yourself. Give yourself a good pinch. If your neighbor isn't doing it, grab some skin cells off the back of his neck. That'll wake him up. All right. Congratulations, you just sent a couple of hundred somatic cells hurling to their deaths on the lap in front of you. Did you just commit mass homicide? Well, wait a minute. Each one of those cells contains your entire DNA encoding. But you didn't commit mass homicide. You know why? Because you know that each of these cells are merely part of a larger human being, you. They are not distinct, whole living beings the way you were when you were an embryo, the way I was when I was an embryo. There is a difference in kind between each of our bodily cells and the embryonic human beings we once were. That's the science of embryology. Why is this difficult for people? Well, one reason is, if we're honest, our intuitions have trouble connecting with that little ball of cells that we each were at one point. We look at that little ball and think, boy, I see that, but I know what the science says, but it's hard to believe that's me back there. But let me give you a little example that will help. How many of you will admit you remember the dark days of photography when you had to take your film to Photomat? Do you remember those dark days? In 1970, Polaroid cameras came on the market. Polaroid cameras were these terribly ugly, awkward-looking things. But they had an advantage. You didn't have to wait for your films. You see, for those of you that are younger, in the old days, what happened was you would shoot your pictures. It would be recorded on this stuff called film, pre-digital time here. You would then wait till you had shot 24 pictures. Then you would take the film out of the camera, drive to the far corner of the supermarket parking lot to this little shack called Photomat, where you would drop off your pictures, wait a month and a half for them to come back overexposed. Do I speak truth? Polaroid allowed you to get your picture instantly. Now let's pretend it's 1970. You're on a safari. You have a Polaroid camera. You're on a Mexican safari, and you just happen to shoot a picture of a black jaguar leaping across the trail in front of us. Nobody films black jaguars, but you did. And as you're excitedly waiting for that picture to emerge, you're going, in 90 seconds, I shot this picture, it's going to come out of the camera, I'm going to pull the paper out of it, I'm going to wait 90 seconds, and it'll be there. And while you're waiting for it to develop, I yank the camera out of your hands, I rip up the picture. Are you angry at me? What if I said to you, there's no jaguar there, that's just a white paper with a brown smudge on it. Would that satisfy you? Not in a million years. You would look at me with fire in your eyes and you would say, are you out of your mind? The jaguar in the picture was already there. We just couldn't see him yet because he was still developing. Men and women, from the earliest stages of development, you were already there. We just couldn't see you.
You're listening to Focus on the Family and a powerful presentation from Scott Klusendorf helping us to learn how to step up and defend the preborn child. Now, we're offering a CD of this message for your gift of any amount to the ministry. You can donate and request that CD at focusonthefamily.com/radio. Here again, Scott Klusendorf.
The science is clear. It's so clear that almost no one today will dispute it. But science alone will not get us where we need to go. Science alone will not tell us why we should not harm the unborn. And that leads us to our next question. What makes us valuable? I want everybody to look around the room right now. Go ahead, just stare at some people. If there's any single guys here and you saw some cute girls you wanted to stare at, now is your sanctified moment to look. Go ahead and stare. Don't laugh. I met my wife that way. All right? Question, what makes us equal? Is it physical ability? If so, we have a problem because we're not all equal physically. At 56, I can still shoot three-pointers, but I don't get open to shoot three-pointers in basketball games, so I'm content with playing horse. Are we all equally self-aware? No, we're not. Are we all equally in possession of a high IQ? No, we are not. If those things give us value and we don't share them equally, guess what just happened to the concept of human equality? It got thrown on the ash heap of history. There's only one thing we all share equally in this room. We all have the same human nature that bears the image of our Maker. If you ground human identity in our capacities, which may come and go, and that none of us share equally, you got a problem. That's why pro-life Christians can answer the equality question. Our secular critics can't. We can. What makes humans equal? Simply this. We all have the same human nature. And men and women, you had that human nature from the moment you began to exist. There's only four differences between you, the embryo, and you, the adult. And not one of those differences is a good reason for saying you could be killed then, but not now. And as Stephen Schwartz points out, if you think of the acronym SLED, you'll remember these four differences: size, level of development, environment, meaning where we're located, and degree of dependency. Not one of those is a good reason for saying you had no value as an embryo, but you do today. Size, you were smaller as an embryo. But since when does body size determine value? Men are generally larger than women. We don't think they deserve more rights than women do. What about your level of development? Were you less developed as an embryo? Of course. But 2-year-old girls are less developed than 21-year-old young women. 2-year-old girls do not have a developed reproductive system yet. It doesn't follow they're less human and valuable because of it. Size, level of development. What about environment, where you were located? You were in the womb, now you're out. How does where you are determine what you are? How does a journey of 8 inches down the birth canal suddenly transform you from non-human, non-valuable thing we can kill to valuable human being that we can't? What about doctors who do fetal surgery? They remove the child mostly from the womb, do the surgery to fix a herniated diaphragm, and then put the child back in the womb at 24 weeks to be born normally at 40. Does that child go from being non-human to briefly being human back to non-human again when it goes back to the womb? Size, level of development, environment, what about degree of dependency? Sure, you depended on your mother, but since when does dependency on another human being mean that we can kill you? Conjoined twins will share each other's vital organs, but we don't intentionally kill them because they can't live independent of one another. Size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency, think SLED. Those four differences are not good reasons for saying you could be killed then, but not now. Now, I want you to take a journey into the future. It is next Thanksgiving. You are at your Thanksgiving table, and your neighbor is your guest, and he does not support your pro-life view. In fact, your neighbor, who we will call James, is actually quite pro-abortion. And while you're sitting there eating your turkey, he turns to you and says, "Now, why are you pro-life?" Here is how you're going to answer him in 1 minute or less. And every one of you here will be able to do this. James, somebody time me, by the way. James, I'm pro-life because the science of embryology says that from the earliest stages of development, you were a distinct, living, and whole human being. And you know what else, James? There's no essential difference between that embryo you once were and the adult you are today that would justify killing you back then. Differences of size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency are not good reasons for saying you could be killed then, but not now. Did I get that done in a minute? Did anybody time me? Where did I come in on that? 30 seconds? I think you need to give it up for me. That was pretty good. That was What is our duty? We've answered the question, what is the unborn? The unborn is a distinct, living, whole human being. We've answered the question, what gives us value? It's not our functions, which vary greatly. It's that we all share the same human nature. So what's our duty in all this? Our duty is to love our unborn neighbor and his mother. And men and women, that won't always be easy. In Luke chapter 10, Jesus tells the story of a man traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. He's beaten up and left for dead beside the road. Two religious leaders pass right on by. And though they would have felt pity for the beating victim, they didn't take pity. And Jesus said, that's not good enough. Only the good Samaritan stepped up and took pity. And Jesus said, that's what it means to love your neighbor. I want you to think of that family in England that stepped up and adopted that girl in 1940. In 1940, men and women, England was facing extinction. Hitler had Europe. We weren't in the war. We were a long way from being in the war. And we weren't providing much help. Britain stood alone. And it would have been very easy for that family to say to themselves, our food is being rationed, our petrol is being rationed, we don't even know if our nation's going to survive. No. That British spirit came out in them. That British spirit that says, we will do our duty. And they stepped up and took that girl in, despite all terror, despite all challenges. And they did it because it was the right thing to do. You will face those who lash out at you for being pro-life. You will have people who do not like what you say. But your job is not to worry about whether you convince them on the spot, though sometimes that will happen. Your job is not to worry about results. Your job is to step up, put a pebble in their shoe, be a faithful ambassador for Jesus, and let a sovereign God take your words and let those words wreak havoc in their hearts for good. And I'm calling on you, men and women, to step up this day and do your duty. We are all apologists now, and I invite you to join me in the trenches. Let's together go out there and give them heaven.
Scott Klusendorf on today's Focus on the Family. And Jim, you and I had the privilege of being part of that staff gathering here at Focus, and we heard Scott deliver this really powerful message.
Oh, yeah. And you know, I love that statement he made there, put a pebble in their shoe. I so like that. You don't have to go smash them in the mouth. Put a pebble in their shoe and let the Holy Spirit do his work in their heart. Kind of that intellectual and spiritual gnawing. It's something that guy said, I can't get away from it. That's what he means by that. And the truth is on our side. There's no denying that all human beings are created by God and are unique and valuable. And Scott has done a great job of explaining that and putting the cookie jar on the lower shelf so we can reach it and understand it better. I want to encourage you to get a copy of today's program, a CD or download, however you can get it. Do the smartphone download of the app. Play it for your small group. Play it for your Sunday school at church. Play it for your children at an age-appropriate level, because it is important for us to anchor ourselves in God's design for humanity, starting in the womb. And as Focus takes steps for life, can I ask you to pray for us and give to Focus? We have got this down to $60 to save a baby's life. We do that through something we call Option Ultrasound, where we place ultrasound machines in pregnancy resource clinics around the country and do trainings to help them get medically ready. I think we've done over 600 installations of that combination. And to date, 382,000 babies have been saved. And I think we can continue that and do much, much more. Someday, soon, I want to see 1 million babies saved, and that's the goal. Can I ask you to help us with a gift of $60 to do that? Save a baby's life today, and when you do, as our way of saying thank you, I'd like to send a copy of Scott's message on CD.
Yeah, and we also would encourage you to look for the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture, when you're online, or ask about it when you have us on the phone. Our number to make that donation, 800, the letter A, and the word family. Or you'll find an opportunity to donate and the book and CD at focusonthefamily.com/radio. Well, next time on Focus on the Family, what to do when beauty and body image become a problem in your family.
I like my red hair, my green eyes, and my freckles. But Mom says I'm not too skinny, not too fat, but I think I'm really chubby.
That's next time on Focus on the Family. Well, I'm John Fuller, and on behalf of Jim Daly and the entire team, thanks for listening, and join us again next time as we once again help you and your family thrive.
Hey, I'm Rod, an audio specialist for Focus on the Family. If our advice and encouragement is making a difference in your family, please let us know. Take our listener survey at focusonthefamily.com/radio. We'd love to hear from you.